Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. President Donald Trump has called the media the enemy of the people and often refers to news stories he doesn't like as fake news. Other politicians and Trump supporters have followed the president's lead. Republicans in particular mistrust the media, and polls have shown many would agree to control the news or put limits on the news that is reported. Journalists have been assaulted and called out publicly by crowds. At the same time, many Americans get their news from outlets that affirm their viewpoints, and false and misleading stories have been planted to influence voters. The messenger is definitely under attack today. Our guest is considered an authority on the future of journalism and the media. Tom Rosensteel is executive director of the American Press Institute and an author, journalist, researcher, and media critic. Mr. Rosensteel, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Journalists have always been criticized throughout American history by those in positions of power. Even though the Founding Fathers made the First Amendment freedom of the press one of the most fundamental rights in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, they often complained about stories written about them. So in the past 250 years, other than technology and the sheer number of media outlets, what has changed?
Well, first of all, you had in the 1840s, you had the invention of telegraph, which allowed people suddenly to know things quite rapidly. That led to the creation of news services. It was shortly after the invention of the telegraph that the Associated Press was created, because we could know things from the West Coast fairly quickly on the East Coast, as opposed to having it go on a stagecoach or a boat. Then we had the advent of radio in the 1920s, and suddenly people could hear the news for themselves. The advent of television in the 1950s, and television news in the 1960s, and people could then see the news for themselves. And then cable in 1980, starting in 1980, and you had the invention of what we now think of as continuous news, or the 24-hour, 7 news cycle. So the notion that this is suddenly changed everything that was a fairly stable system really isn't the case. It's just the stable system that we remember personally. The other thing that's interesting is that trust in the press actually began to decline in the 1980s, and half of the decline in trust in media, in journalism, happened between 1980 and 1997, before the internet. What was going on then? Well, the first thing was cable television expanded the TV dial from 4 to 40 to 400 to whatever it is now. That gave people more choices. We saw the deregulation of media under the Reagan administration. And in radio in particular, this form, this new, what we called at the time, new media of talk radio, came along and marketed itself as the alternative or the antidote to the liberal press. And so notions of that the press was a liberal activist wing of the Democratic Party, that began to seep into the rhetoric and language and thinking of even Republican politicians noticeably more after the 1980s. I mean, Trump's rhetoric bears very little resemblance to the kinds of things that Ronald Reagan would have said.
So the technology actually contributed greatly to the mistrust in media today.
I think so. I think it's choice, which leads to then people marketing themselves a certain way to win over audience. So it's technology and commercialism which leads to this. Technology has also allowed the parties to nationalize their rhetoric so that whatever Trump does is mimicked on a local level. People want to be kind of the local version of Trump or the local version of Bernie, because that's what people are consuming. In fact, the interest in local news has even dropped as the internet has come along, because people have had more access to national news, which is interesting and entertaining.
So, when I went back to the history and talked about the Founding Fathers and all throughout American history where people in positions of power have been critical of the media, as you just showed, technology has greatly influenced that. So maybe I should ask the question more specifically in that, what's different between today's position, people in positions of power being critical of the media than, say, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago during the Reagan administration?
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an old saying, never argue with somebody who, you know, buys ink by the barrel. And the, you know, what the implication of that is, you know, if you're a political figure, you can't, there's only so far you can go in being critical of television and newspapers and radio because they command such large audiences. That's really what's changed. There are so many outlets now that Trump can afford to call the mainstream press, which is what he really means, fake news, because there's a whole network, a whole ecosystem of other places, many of which may not actually be, you know, sort of qualify as journalism, where he can get news and information from, and where he thinks his supporters are getting news and information from. There was a time when you couldn't have done that because there were four TV stations in a given place, and the anchor team of you know, the most popular TV station in town was very powerful. Even in the 1990s, when we began to see the use of satellite technology in a bigger way, it was considered somewhat revolutionary that a candidate would sit in a chair and do, you know, a local feed after local feed after local feed to talk to and try and woo local anchor people on television. You couldn't have done that, you know, in the 1960s, and that was a way of bypassing, you know, the network anchors. To some degree, the consistent pattern has always been, I am going to figure out some way around the national press that is most critical of me, knows the most about me, is in the strongest position to point out the things that I get wrong or that I've made mistakes on.
You use the term mainstream press. Many conservatives refer to the national media as the mainstream media, or the SMM, they've abbreviated. Who is the mainstream media?
Well, that's a great question, because the mainstream media suggests that there is a mainstream and then there's everything else. And that's probably an antiquated term now. What we really have are a lot of niches. The number of people who are on BuzzFeed every day, you know, rivals the number of people who are reading what we, you know, might have considered the website of the mainstream media 5 years ago. If you were going to say what is the largest channel of information today, it would be Facebook. So Facebook probably qualifies as the mainstream media more than CBS or ABC.
Boy, a lot of our listeners hearing that are just fell out of their chairs. Isn't that something that my kids use? Okay, yes, I'm on Facebook, but that's mainstream nowadays?
The reason for that is the sheer volume of traffic that flows through Facebook. You know, one thing that's interesting is when Facebook started, and we were tracking that younger people were using it a lot, there was this grave concern that then young people are not getting any news because they're not going to news sources. What we've discovered in the last 5 years is that there's an enormous amount of news that's shared on Facebook. Oh, and by the way, now that your grandparents are on Facebook, it's not just young people who are sharing news there. And certainly the 2016 election illustrated the power and the risks of that. Most news organizations, when they look at their digital information, their data, their analytics, discover that Facebook is the single largest deliverer or entry point for their for people coming to their website. And that means that they are coming because they saw a story shared by someone in their Facebook network. And they clicked on that story and arrived at you know, the Philadelphia Inquirer or, you know, WTIF or somewhere. And they didn't come to the front page of that website. They came through that one story. So we also have, as a consequence, the majority of traffic to a news site is probably on a phone. And it's probably somebody who only comes once a month or maybe a couple times a month and is not a regular user. So the definition of everybody's audience has been radically changed by this.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the criticisms of today's journalist and some that the president would have and his supporters. Some of those criticisms, mostly from conservatives, that the mainstream media, or as they refer to journalists, are out of touch with real Americans beyond New York, Washington, and Los Angeles. They don't know what's important to real Americans. Basically, they're saying that journalists in those three cities where most of the news comes from, or the networks are located, the big newspapers are located, that they're out of touch with everyday Americans. What about that?
Well, there is sort of some grain of physical truth to that, in the sense that major news organizations are located where there's heavy concentrations of people. So even the New York Times, when it sends somebody to, when it, you know, until this last year, you know, they say, well, we're going to have somebody in a Southwest bureau. They send them to a big city in Texas to live. It's easier to get around from there. You're near an airport, et cetera, et cetera. They don't send them to some rural, out of the way place and put their bureau there. So to the extent that journalists live in urban environments, you know, that's true. To the extent that that journalists are themselves well educated and, you know, kind of operate in an upper middle class environment, that's also true. However, the notion that all journalists were born in these places and that that's the only thing they know is not true. There's tons of folks who work in the news business who, in fact, come from all over the country. And one of the interesting things is that there's a long tradition of journalism as a kind of step up out of the working class for people. And one of the reasons for that is because journalism has always been a way for people to sort of make connections and create community. And people who have been interested in that historically have been people who don't have a lot of power. They're not elites. They may be immigrants. And they are very interested in how communities work. And it's true in my case. I came from a pretty working class background. I was in a meeting once with a famous journalistic historian named Jim Carrey, who said, it's not entirely true, but mostly true, that all of the great journalists in American history have been from the working class, and all of the great publishers in American history have been immigrants. And it's a generalization, but there's a number of really strong examples that carry that out.
Many people, though, who have mistrust of the media, if they don't refer to them as elitist or think that they're out of touch, think that there is an agenda. And most often they think that is a liberal agenda. We do know from surveys that most journalists, especially in the larger metropolitan areas, probably personally are liberal politically. But that bias, the critics would say that bias shows through, that they have a bias against middle America, against the working class in America.
Yeah. So the data here is interesting. You know, we used to live in a world way back and before the 1960s where you had competing newspapers in town. And those competing newspapers competed for audience along partisan lines. There was a working class. There was a blue-collar paper. There was a pro-union paper, an anti-union paper. There was a, you know, the establishment Republican paper. I worked for many years at the LA Times. It was basically a fact that the Republican Party of California and Los Angeles was run out of the LA Times newsroom by the political editor of the LA Times. So it was not a liberal. It was not a liberal place. As we saw a contraction in media in the '60s with the death of newspapers, some of that diversity went away, and then gradually over from the 70s to now, we saw fewer and fewer conservatives working in newsrooms. Not so much that the newsrooms became more liberal as that the conservatives sort of disappeared. That is a problem. And, you know, news people, I think one of the criticisms I have of the way news organizations work is they don't ask people their politics. So they don't want to go there. It's sort of a third rail. And then you end up with a phenomenon of journalists hiring people who are just a lot like themselves. And that's narrowed, I think, the newsrooms ideologically. If we think that diversity is a good thing, and that we want to hire newsrooms that look more like America and reflect the diversity of America, that has got to include people who disagree politically, or you're just not going to be able to empathize with the country that you're trying to cover. The notion, however, that I think Trump implies that journalists are actively trying to help one side and hurt another, that is manifestly not the case. Journalists, it's not in their economic interest to do that. It doesn't help the accuracy of their journalism. Where journalists fail, I think, is when they sort of don't understand a part of the country or a part of the political debate, and they dismiss it or they're just not hearing it. So journalists themselves were, if they didn't understand red state rural America in the last election, journalists were more embarrassed by that than anyone else.
You partially answered this, but you've been in the media, been a journalist, author for 4 decades now. How many people have you heard your colleagues say, I'm going to stick it to this guy, or I don't agree with this guy, so we're not going to cover his point of view?
Basically never. The worst thing you can say in a newsroom about somebody is they're biased, that they're unfair. The second worst thing you can say is that they're soft and that their stuff is too positive about the person they cover. Look, Bill Clinton did not have an easy time of it with the press, nor did Barack Obama, who was more aggressive about trying to prosecute journalists than any president in recent history. People in power don't like to get covered. You know, when you mentioned the Founding Fathers, you know, Thomas Jefferson, who would be considered the sort of, you know, the grandfather of the Democratic Party, today. He hated the press when he was president. He honored the press when he was, you know, when he was out of power. Mm. And I think that's, you know, essentially that's the role the press plays. They monitor people in power and try and keep them, you know, they try and keep them honest. They try and catch them at things. They, you know, they try and be a watchdog and shine lights in dark corners, and not to get be duped. You know, another thing that you, another insult that you can hurl in a newsroom is to say, "A guy's coverage is very stenographic." You know, he just writes down what he's told and puts it, you know, on the air. These are all things that anything that shows a lack of skepticism. Is something that in the ethos of journalism is considered a weakness.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Tom Rosensteel, who is executive director of the American Press Institute. He's an author, journalist, researcher, and media critic. And we're talking about the role of media today and mistrust in the media in particular. Something else, Mr. Rosensteel, that has occurred in the last few years and probably goes back to what you had described earlier with that technology, especially the advent of cable television, how radio talk shows became so partisan in many cases, and that is that many Americans get their news from outlets that affirm their point of view. And if they don't agree with it, they want nothing to do with it. This is a real problem.
Yeah, it is. And it's what you'd call in the academic business a wicked problem. There are many, many causes that interact and converge to create this. One is that the research shows that people don't remember stuff that they completely disagree with. There's some groundbreaking research about television that stories that don't connect to your life, because we have to watch television, traditional television, story after story after story, and you don't necessarily remember what the sequence of story was. So stories that don't connect to your own experience, you actually just don't remember them. It's like they evaporate somewhere between the television set and our brains. Another is, the phenomenon we call confirmation bias, which is you like stories that align the world to the way that you see it. So I like Sean Hannity. He makes a lot of sense for me. Or I really like Rachel Maddow. You know, she puts things in order. And I think the appeal of that is increased by the speed with which we get information. So all day long, instead of being just at your job and living your life, we're getting a lot of headlines now. By the time you get home, you probably know the basics of what might be on the front page, if not the details. So there's a yearning, and this is why you see these talk shows on cable in the evening, for help me put this into some order where I feel I'm comfortable again at the end of the day. How can I understand this? Tillerson, is replaced by Trump today. What does that mean? How do I align this so that I can go to bed tonight in a comfortable place? Add yet another convergence to this, which is that the social networks, which have become so powerful in our lives, Twitter and Facebook and even Google, to the extent that it is refining search, their economic model is to accentuate our differences. Facebook sells targeted advertising. So their model is to say how you are different than I am, and that the ads that you see should be absolutely distinctive. So they have identified all of the subgroups that you belong to, and if we looked at the same website at the same time, we would see different ads based on all of your past behavior, your hobbies and everything else, and everything you've looked at. So Facebook's model is built around identifying how we are different from each other than how we are similar. There's a whole technological infrastructure now designed to accentuate our differences. And that infrastructure is yet another factor here, is what the Russian program of disinformation during the 2016 election was designed to exploit. And that's happening in country after country as this state-sponsored program fill our social streams with things that divide us and things that make us mad. So this really is a wicked problem, part psychology, part human nature, part technology, and part the way we've allowed the social networks to build themselves.
And reason for pessimism, I'd say that we as a nation will ever come together. I mean, we're so divided right now, but when we are on Facebook or Twitter, maybe 3 hours out of the day, and we're getting bombarded with these messages that divide us, how can we ever come together?
Well, there's a couple of things that people are thinking about. It's quite possible, it's certainly going to be on the agenda, that social networks will be regulated and that they will not be allowed to be in our lives quite as much as they are. The amount of information that Google has about you, because you have to remember, Google is not just a search engine. It's also an operating system, and they make phones. And so they know pretty much, if you use Gmail, their algorithms read your email. So the ads that you see through Google are also based on the words that are in your private emails. And all of that is unregulated. So regulating the platforms is one of the options that people are talking about. Another is that the algorithms themselves could be altered. Facebook has talked about they value what you click on, but they could just as easily change their algorithms so that you would see a diversity of views. That's up to them. At the moment, they are not interested in that, but they have that ability. And there's also a discussion of not letting these companies vertically integrate across different business lines the way they have. At the moment, we're in a kind of anti-regulatory environment, but the politics of that could change because while Silicon Valley is sort of libertarian in nature, it's also perceived as socially liberal. And Republicans, and so there's a possibility of Republicans and Democrats coming together to take some of this regulatory relief. There's something we can do as consumers as well, although it's tricky. You can go in and essentially confuse the algorithm if you decide, you know what, I'm just going to start liking some people who I disagree with because I want to see a range of things. So regardless of whatever your politics are, you can go in and say, well, I'm a conservative, but I want to actually hear what Rachel Maddow has to say. I want to click on the New York Times in addition to the Wall Street Journal, and I love Breitbart. So you can confuse the algorithm if you decide you want to create a diversity of information in your stream. It's something that we actually can control. Most people don't really know how to do it and don't think about it. But I know some scholars who have done it, and they said it's been pretty revolutionary.
I don't know. Good luck with that, because we're most often what will happen is we unfriend those people that we disagree with on Facebook. I want to get back to the politics of it. How much of an impact has Donald Trump had on this conversation?
It's enormous. Now, I think it's worth pointing out, as we mentioned before, that the preconditions were all there. Trump didn't create this situation. He has taken advantage of it. The decline in trust, as I said earlier, began in the 1980s. There's been a 34% drop overall in trust, but 17% of those percentage points happened before the internet, and almost all of it happened before Trump took office. In fact, if you're just looking at trust, Trump's had no impact on it. Democrats actually trust the press a little more since the election, and Republicans are no more distrustful than they were in sheer numbers. The nature of their distrust may be different. But if you go inside that, I think Trump's had a huge impact. For one thing, the term fake news, which was originally meant to describe news that never happened from news organizations that don't really exist, from fake news organizations, he has appropriated that term to mean news that is critical of him, that he disagrees with. Now, in survey research, we see that about 44% of Americans say they believe that journalists and news organizations make up information that never happened. I don't think we would have seen – first of all, the question was never even asked on surveys prior to Trump's presidency, and we certainly wouldn't have seen that concept there. It wasn't even a concept that pollsters had imagined. He's also stiffened the spine of the press, because journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post and elsewhere who have been described as the enemy of the people, their instinct is not to, well, okay, let's be nice to him so that he doesn't call us those mean words. Just the opposite probably has happened. The press has become more aggressive to be a watchdog of Trump's presidency. At the same time, I think he's also improved the transparency of the press, because to prove to their readers and listeners that these stories are real, they are sharing more about how they've done the reporting. So it's not uncommon to see a story that will say, this story is based on 14 interviews with people inside the Trump West Wing. That's a level of transparency or looking inside the reporting process that we have never seen before. It's also very clearly the case that reporters are making sure they've got more interviews to back up their stories than they used to, precisely because they know they'll be attacked instantly. I mean, the things we remember as the big goofs during Trump's presidency is a Wire reporter who briefly mentioned that he thought a piece of art had been removed from the Oval Office. And when it was proven that that it was not the case, he immediately corrected it. But that we still remember that, and that won one of Trump's fake news awards, and a mistake by a reporter at ABC News that basically cost that reporter his job. So the press is also very vigilant about correcting any errors and sort of disciplining the people who've made them. The challenge, I know it's a long answer, but the challenge for the press is how do you cover someone in a dispassionate way who says you're the enemy? That's almost an existential crisis for journalists.
Along those lines, the media is getting criticism from both sides. You have liberals who believe that reporters, journalists should normalize Donald Trump, that he's unique and that we shouldn't cover him like we have covered past administrations. And then you have conservatives who think that the media is out to get Trump. You touched on that a little bit. So it's kind of a no-win situation. How does journalism move forward with those conditions?
Well, I mean, I think that although the press may not be popular for doing this because they are going to get attacked by both sides, I think the answer, to oversimplify it, is to do your job in the sense that you don't decide that you're going to be out to get him. That doesn't really serve. He may say you're his enemy, but you don't want him to become your enemy. You need to sort of rise above that rhetoric and do and do what you're supposed to do, which is to provide the public with accurate information, to put it in context, keep it in proportion, make sure that it's right, and to offer what some people call the plumb line. You know, in construction, a plumb line is where you hang a weight on a string and you know what a straight line is. And to some extent, journalism has always been, okay, here's the range of things that are being said, and I need to see that full spectrum of things. I need to know the discussion that's going on, so I can decide where I sort of reside inside that conversation. That requires journalists to be talking to everybody who's in the conversation, people who hate them, people who like them, and to give me an accurate portrayal of what the mood is on the Hill. One of the challenges for the press there is that there are a lot of Republicans who in private are alarmed by Trump. They don't say those things publicly, but they do talk that way to journalists privately. And that alarm inside the Republican Party creates a kind of tone, a kind of background music that we see in the press coverage that we get. So you'll see an alarmism in the coverage, some of which is coming invisibly from inside Trump's party, particularly in the Senate.
So moving forward, in summary, how can journalism regain the public's trust and improve what journalists do?
Well, to some extent, they're not going to regain it in the sense that they might have had it in the days when there were 25 news outlets that, you know, dominated the market. We can't go backwards. And to some extent, the press is judged by looking backwards. Did they get this right? The Washington Post was enormously unpopular during the Watergate period. In fact, Len Downey was the city editor for Woodward and Bernstein at the time, and then later the editor of the Washington Post after Ben Bradley, told me that they started covering that story in June when the break-in happened, and they were basically alone until October, when Walter Cronkite did a long report on the CBS Evening News, but virtually alone among newspapers until January. So that's 6 months when you're hanging out there all by yourself on a story and everyone else in the press is telling you you've lost your marbles. Now we look back at that as a moment of, sort of stellar watchdog reporting because they were on a story. But, it was not popular in the moment. So I think you've got to kind of keep your eye on getting the story right and figure that history will be the judge and not worry too much about your Gallup numbers.
Tom Rosensteel is executive director of the American Press Institute. He's an author, journalist, researcher, and media critic. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. Three exhibits by one artist, all very close to one another geographically. The artist is renowned printmaker and naturalist Ladislav Hanka, who even amongst artists is truly unique and has a diverse background. The exhibits can be seen between now and April 29th at Susquehanna Art Museum in Harrisburg and at the High Center and Murray Library on the campus of Messiah College. Ladislav Hanka joins us on the phone right now from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Mr. Hanka, thank you for being with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. You have a Bachelor of Science degree in biology and an MS in zoology. How does one become an artist with that kind of background?
Ah, yes. Well, one becomes an artist with that kind of background by caring deeply about things, getting interested in the natural world, and taking it further. I would have to say that really there's a common denominator at play at all this, and it's probably pretty much the kid that has to get his hands on all the salamanders and nose in the dirt and just figure it all out. And some point in your life, you figure out that you better make a living at it, and so you become a scientist. But, of course, interpreting it all through art is a time-honored tradition, too. You go all the way back to Rembrandt, Da Vinci, Luis Agassiz Fuertes, Audubon. There are all kinds of people out there that manage to somehow tread that more emotional kind of look at art as well as a scientific investigation. And I don't think they're in any way a contradiction to one another. I make art with bees. That's what we're talking about here. That's the show that's up in all three places, basically, that I put my artwork into the beehives. And if you take that back, just to take that question right back to its beginnings, well, I'm sort of like the kid making mud pies. I've got bees in one hand and artwork in the other, and then just somehow the self-evident thing is to smash those two hands together like you're making mud pies, and, well, that's kind of interesting. Let's see where that's going to go. And that's, to some degree, it. And yeah. When you were talking about this last program you had, and I was listening, and you're questioning the press, and, I'm exactly that kind of guy, looking at all the environmental press, looking at the science, I'm looking at the beekeeping, even the science of it. And, I have my doubts about some of the press, but I got to tell you, there's a lot of good information out there that's accurate, too. And I know that because I've got my hands in it.
I'm curious, were you one of those kids that had your hands in the dirt and was playing with salamanders?
Oh, God, yes. It was all over in that stuff. Your dad takes you out fishing and you really get into cleaning the fish. Oh, my goodness, look at the guts in there. Look at them. They've got parasites inside of them. That's just gross. We're going to cook them. Okay, it's good. So that kills the parasites. We're not going to get, horrible intestinal infections from eating these fish. But, yeah, I was in all of that stuff. And it's fascinating. And it's the things of this world. The scientists I love, they're like Rupert Sheldrake or, like just Stephen Hawking that just died. The people that never lose their curiosity. And I think it leads you to being an artist as much as a scientist. They're not really in contradiction to one another, unless, of course, you start drinking the Kool-Aid and taking too much money from the kinds of people who are making too much money from it and have a vested interest. Maybe misleading you, but for the most part, the real scientists and real artists, they don't want to mislead anybody. We don't know all the answers. We're just fascinated by the questions.
You have said that art is your true calling, though, even though you had this background in science, that and this is how you make your living today, is through art. Why is art your true calling?
Boy, that's a hard one to answer sometimes. I look at it all the time, turn it over one side or the other, because there is that fascination I think any of us has with not getting too tunnel vision, that they're just doing one thing in your life. You do that scattergun thing. You look at everything in the world. I think that's what happens to the artist, that you don't want to just be, you know, a game warden or a manager of something or working for somebody. You become self-employed, and you just generate ideas, and you draw pictures, and then you move on to something else. There's an incredible freedom that that has. And I suppose ultimately it's because I'm the guy that also just wants to meditate and go into dream time, you know. It's the folklorist in me as well, all that. And so putting it all together in some way that you can do on your own and do in a sensual way, you know. It's like the myth makers. They are the ones that tell us the ultimate truth, the ones that can't mislead you. You know, that's the Joseph Campbell in us that just wants to know what goes on, that, you know, the myths, the things that your mother told you in the cradle, the folk songs, the stories, and there's so much truth in them. And it somehow all comes together in the arts, and it's sensual. It's just drawing a picture that looks beautiful.
You mentioned your exhibits here in Harrisburg at the Susquehanna Art Museum and on the campus of Messiah College, and how bees are involved in that. You have a series of etchings placed in beehives. Now, I just want to make sure that everyone in the audience not familiar with your work understands. Etchings placed in beehives. The bees have contributed to the art. In what way?
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so wonderful, because it just takes me out of my own, you know, intellectual constructs and my own ego speaking. There's another creature involved, another consciousness that's brought to bear on this. So, yes, I make that etching just as, you know, maybe Rembrandt would have in the 18th century. No big difference there, no big major technological break here. I'm drawing pictures, etching them into a copper plate, taking an impression into paper, using just the same old inks that have been made for centuries. And then those pictures that I've made that are maybe a picture of a bee tree or of sort of a dragonfly or things from this earth that all of us are accustomed to seeing, and hopefully I bring to it maybe a slightly different vision, but they're very recognizable. You know what you're looking at. And then I put that into a beehive, glued down on a board, and bees start chewing up at the edges. They'll start making honeycomb all over it. If I leave it in there too long, they'll cover it over completely. Put in honey, cap it over, and you won't see a darn thing. If I pull it out in time, you'll see bits and pieces of my etching coming through and bits and pieces of honeycomb that bees have built on it, and they are spectacular. They just build all this honeycomb every which way, and I can't control that, but I can give them a lot of wax to work with. Now, think about that. A bee invests about 7 times as much energy into making wax as it does into honey. So wax, super valuable substance. The bees do not waste it. If I give them wax, just old wax from another hive, they'll just chew up that wax, move it around, make things with it, and they start to make structures that are, I think, not just completely the natural beehive structure. They are responding to an intrusion, covering it up. They're messing with it. And, of course, I like to imagine that in some way or another, those bees are in contact with me, the beekeeper, you know, like a pet owner with their own pet. That there is a communication of some sort happening there. And, you know, it may not be great science, but it is good myth. And you think about art and myth and all that stuff that goes out there, and all the various mystics in humanity that have, you know, talked about speaking to the dead, and, you know, it comes together in ways that start to be fascinating. And you can't really say that bees aren't intelligent. You know, there's much we don't know, but they have a brain the size of a pinhead, I'll grant you that, but there's 50,000 of them in a hive there, right? So that's the population of a small town, a kind of town that has a police force, hospitals, manufacturing, you know, school teachers and delinquents. It's got the whole spectrum. So maybe a beehive is something like that, that has the whole spectrum, and it's a social structure that's complex. And so there's a place for your imagination to go feral and wild, you know.
I'm just sitting here right now imagining the bad bees and the bees who are the leaders of the community that you're describing. We're speaking with artist Ladislav Hanka. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk WITF. You were a beekeeper. Maybe you still are. Maybe you still do keep bees. But did you have an aha moment or where you said, you know what, there is art here. When I look at these hives, when I look at this community of bees, there's art here. I mean, did that strike you one day, or is it something that just you realized all along?
No, not really. You get interested in stuff, and it starts evolving in your head in some simple way. And like I said, slap them together and just see what my two interests combined will do. And I don't think it's some big, great act of genius. It's something that's occurred to other people, too. I think all kinds of things occur to people. There's billions of us. There's millions of beekeepers all over the world. There's millions of artists. I'm sure they've exhausted all kinds of possibilities. And yet, there you are, playing with it. And as you get playful, things evolve and happen. And those first pieces I put in there, weren't that interesting? They were cool. They were a great beginning. They got me excited. And I learned how to work with it, how to maybe encourage the bees to do a little bit more. Maybe I got a little bit more daring and didn't take the artwork away from them too fast, let them really build up interesting structures. All of that is what's happening out there.
Etchings are your specialty, so not surprisingly, the lines that you draw are precise and maybe unlike any other artist out there. I mean, you mentioned Audubon, and I have to admit the subject material, Audubon, of course, was famous for mostly birds, but nature. So when you mention Audubon, I'm not surprised that that is one of the artists that you admire. But your lines are so precise. Talk about that and you know, just how important that precision is.
Oh, it's extremely important to me. There's just something about line being the fundament upon which all art is built. Drawing is the skeletal structure of artwork. You can't pull off a good etching or a painting or a sculpture unless you've got your drawing down, and that's what it's all built upon. It's just like skeletons, you know, that underlie the musculature and all the ligaments and tendons in a body. You can't go out there and draw a nice figure until you've figured out how it articulates at the shoulder joints. And, you know, I've had all these artists come in and all these art students that I've talked to over the years, and, you know, there's nothing quite like, you know, the young art student that comes in and does you a figure drawing with luscious breasts. Who doesn't love breasts, you know? And then you kind of say, well, now you've got to work on figuring out those fingers and foot bones, because you've got, you know, some claws on the end of her hands, and you've got some real ugly hoofs on the end of her feet, and you just got a drawing that's no dang good. Go back and learn the hard stuff. But of course, and it's all the precision of really not fudging anything, not just smudging it around with a bit of charcoal and some smearing around some paint, but really committing with a line that follows a contour of something that actually skates across an open area and just defines where the shadow falls across something that actually creates volume.
We only have
that's wonderful.
We only have a minute left, and I want to thank you very much for. Oh, no, that's fine. In that minute, could you describe what those who will come to see your exhibits at the Susquehanna Art Museum and at Messiah College, what they can expect between now and April 29th?
Well, they will see those etchings we've described that will be covered over in honeycomb, nicely framed. But it's also worth mentioning, I'm going to be doing a talk on the 29th of April at 3 p.m. at the Susquehanna Arts Center, and that will be a gallery walk where I'll actually take you through and talk about things, and you can collar me and ask me specific questions, and I think that'll be fun for people.
I think they'll enjoy that, too. Artist Ladislav Hanka, it's been an honor to talk to you today, and we're looking forward to seeing you here in Central Pennsylvania on April 29th, but thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You know, we try to bring all kinds of diversity here to Smart Talk, and I have to say that Ladislav Hanka is one of the most unique artists that we will see here in central Pennsylvania. So I encourage you, if you have the opportunity, to get out and see those exhibits between now and the end of April. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it is the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. If you follow WITF at all, you probably are aware that last year with Ken Burns' the Vietnam War series, that we focused a lot on Vietnam. My Lai was probably the turning point in Vietnam, in that it kind of turned many Americans against the war in Vietnam and changed the whole narrative. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. And also, second part of the program, something on a little brighter note involving the U.S. Army.